What does it mean to be rich? Is it having more stories to share or time to give? Is it being able to keep your loved ones close or travel somewhere far away? At Edward Jones, we believe the key to being rich is knowing what counts. Your dedicated financial advisor will take a comprehensive approach to your financial strategy to help support what truly matters to you. EdwardJones.com/findyourrich. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
Live from the Nasdaq market site in the heart of New York City's Times Square, this is Fast Money. Here's what's on tap tonight. Netflix gets chilled. The streaming giant adding more than twice as many subscribers as expected, handily beating profit and revenue estimates. So why are shares dropping? We'll look for some answers. Plus, a date with Destiny. Last week, we brought you an interview with the founder of the Destiny Tech 100, a new closed-end fund that lets retail investors get in on still private companies. But is the product full of promise or plagued with pitfalls? We're digging in. And later, Tesla tests the key $150 level. Wells Fargo hits a more than two-year high. And United Air keeps flying higher. We've got all the trades on all of these moves coming up. I'm Melissa Lee, coming to you live from Studio B at the Nasdaq on the desk tonight. Tim Seymour, Dan Nathan, Steve Grasso, and Katie Stockton, founder and managing partner of Fair Lead Strategies. Welcome, Katie.
Thank you.
And we start off with Netflix's volatile moves after announcing that it will stop reporting subscriber numbers and average revenue per viewer on a quarterly basis. The streaming giant, though, did beat top and bottom line estimates. The conference call is underway. CNBC's Steve Kovac has been listening in. Steve, what's the latest?
Yeah, and a little more color on the call from that decision to stop reporting subscribers. But first, let's go over the big results. Netflix beating expectations again on the top and bottom lines and just blowing away expectations on those subscriber additions. The momentum and growth from cracking down on password sharing continues. Subscriber adds came in at 9.33 million. That was compared to the just 4.5 million the street was expecting. But don't get too used to judging Netflix by subscribers. Companies saying today it will stop reporting quarterly subscriber numbers and average revenue per membership starting next year with its first quarter 2025 earnings report. Netflix's reasoning for that, it says revenue and engagement are better metrics of its success, not the number of subscribers. Also because of the variety of pricing plans, share plans, and ad-supported tiers it offers now. As for guidance, revenue for the second quarter was a hair lighter than expectations, $9.49 billion. That'd be up about 16% compared to the year-ago quarter. We're about 15 minutes of the call. A little more commentary on the subscriber disclosures there. Co-CEO Greg Peters basically saying you can no longer multiply the cost of subscription by the number of subscribers because of so many plans. It's better to look at engagement and just overall revenue, Melissa.
All right, Steve, thanks. Steve Kovac, it does make sense here. And on the second quarter revenue number, we were expecting a decline because of just typical seasonality, but this was still worse than had been expected. Tim, what'd you make?
It was a miss. It was a miss for a company that's been, let's be clear, I'm sure Katie's got a view on the charts. It's great having you. But it doubled in 4 months. So a stock that's also done not a whole lot going into those numbers has been kind of flat. It's still a cash flow machine relative to the other media stocks out there. Valuation, certainly we've talked about this all the time. It's probably grown into a growthier valuation. And when I look at their international opportunities and the critical mass they have, and we talk all the time about structurally why they may be more efficient in terms of their content creation and why their model works. So we've all grappled and gotten snarky on different reporting requirements, who's changed kind of the rules of the game, who's changed the metrics we look at, even Apple, right? I mean, Apple was doing this. So I'm not too bothered by it, but I'm not a Netflix analyst day by day.
Whenever something changes the metrics, you think they're hiding something. So I think that's what the analyst community always thinks. But Tim mentioned revenue. They make more than all the others lose combined. That's a huge number for them. So they're still the mainstay. They're still the elephant in the room, if you will. I want to know password sharing. How far along are they on password sharing? What's the percentage of it? Are they almost done there? What do they have left? And the ad tier, that has not rolled out through all the different segments. Password sharing has. So that would be what I would be concerned with.
Yeah, ad-based subscriptions was like 65% sequentially up, you know, so that's something that I think folks were initially kind of, I don't know, not that optimistic about, and it's a very high margin sort of business, especially if you're capturing people that were using multiple passwords and the like, and so that represented, I think it said 40% of all new net ads, so that's good stuff there. You know, margin improvement, I think, is pretty impressive, and if you think about it, I mean, year over year, there was an easy comp, I think, versus last Q1 or so, but, you know, up 35% expected for this year in earnings, 15% expected sales growth, trading about 35 times. You know, we talk about a lot of stocks that, you know, they have like a peg that looks a little bit off. And then if you look at it versus a multiple of sales.
I want to explain peg, Dan.
Well, it's a PE to growth, Tim.
Oh, yes. Oh,
no, no, but it's
oh,
no.
Oh, because oh, you're
I'm
ARPU.
Mr. ARPU. No, I, yeah. You can be the peg guy now. Yeah. No, it's a great metric, and I'm not messing with you. I barely knew it.
No, but it's funny. I mean, we talked about like how inexpensive Netflix got when it declined 75% right. from those. And I think a lot of us on the desk bought that stock down there in the hole. It gets a little harder up here, but on a peg basis, it looks fairly reasonable for a company growing like this.
Out of the charts, look.
You know, it's outperformed pretty consistently since 2022 after that big swoon lower. And I think a pullback or correction, more accurately, would be welcomed in this name. It has outperformed and it has that upside momentum longer term. So when you get the pullbacks, it could even honestly fill that gap from January, which would mean, and this would require weaker tape than we even have right now, but that would be a move down to about 500 for Netflix. I think that would be bought up right away.
You know, one thing, and I think Kovac just said this, is like they're explaining the change in the metrics because they have lots of different plans. We talked a few weeks ago about some of the stuff that they're doing in live, right? Mm-hmm. So this summer, they're going to have this fight with Mike Tyson and one of the Logan guys or one of these guys, you know, and it's going to be a live, you know, kind of pay. Like, can you imagine what the subscriptions we're talking about? They just beat 9.5 on a 5 million estimate. Into that, you might see a huge run up. You know what I mean? You might see a huge run up in ad base. I don't
just
know.
Just for this one.
Just
fight.
For that one. I mean, well, think about that event. I mean, it's only going to be on Netflix.
And I think it's really interesting for their advertising revenue stream, which so far has been nothing, but I think it will actually be something. And I think that's one of the drivers or a catalyst or at least a fundamental part of the Netflix story that the analyst community hasn't really been able to do much. Where do we get from, you know, crawling to actually walking or whatever sequence we want to do there? I also think that what inning are we in terms of paid sharing? I mean, it's hard to really know if we're, you know, halfway through this great,
you
know, yeah. I mean, I've read a bunch of the street over the last couple of days into these numbers. I think it's very mixed. I think there are people that think they're very early in the paid sharing dynamic.
Yeah, yeah. Who are the Logan brothers?
They're
Jake
like
Paul.
These YouTube.
Yeah, Jake Paul.
Whatever. No, Logan
whatever.
Paul is one of them. That's why. I just got it mixed up. Isn't Logan Paul one of these guys?
I don't know.
It's not
a
tag team match. I think he's just fine.
It's one guy against Mike Tyson.
WWE. But like, think about this. If you're some kid and you've been on your parents' thing and they crack down on passwords and you want to watch that fight, you're going to subscribe. You're going to figure out how to subscribe to Netflix. Sure. Then you're probably going to forget to cancel it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. In terms of the Netflix story, though, I mean, isn't part of the story the weakness of the others? I mean, isn't that what we've seen more and more underscored by every comment that Paramount makes, that Disney makes? I mean, Disney said, we're going to play to be number two.
Disney's trying.
And we're going to do password crackdowns, too. Just like Netflix.
They're trying to get to profitability in streaming, and that's been part of the driver for the stock is they've actually given you visibility into that. I don't know, Steve, you had something to say.
No, she was pointing at you, but so I'll wait for you to finish. We're on the air for another 53 minutes, so I better have something.
Okay, all right. Well, and I can talk for 53 minutes straight.
But
as we know.
Somebody help me out here. No, I actually think the operating margin, which they set for 24%, they set the bar a little bit high, and I think that's part of the reason why I think the expectations were so high.
Yeah.
Disney is definitely the second player. So if there's anyone who's going to make it, it's Disney. We still talk about Disney's the king of content. I don't know where that conversation went, but I think we should be talking more about Netflix now as far as when they're going to increase pricing. Because now you have that ad tier, so it gives them a little bit of a buffer where if you want to have a cheaper account, it's ad tier. You want to pay, they have the unlimited to go out to the upside.
Katie, the gap from last quarter, it went from just below 500 up to 550, and then it just kept on going, right?
It didn't look back, but a very strong tape at the time.
Right, and so, like, if you were to see, wouldn't 550, we're at 590 in the aftermarket, I'm just saying, let's say this 5% pullback in the S&P turns into a 10%, the stock could be down at 550, maybe testing that gap. And given, like, I think we all sound fairly positive on the fundamental setup here. Would that be a good level, you think, to start
picking
it? It
depends, I think, on the top-down influences. So we're expecting an oversold bounce, and I don't think Netflix will be excluded from that, especially if it gaps down tomorrow, which it's looking like. And that 550, so the gap does have support at its upper boundary and also its lower boundary. So my playbook, I would say, would be for a bounce off of that upper boundary, perhaps, and then something that goes for a retest and maybe fills that gap. So a short-term buyer might benefit from it, but maybe an intermediate-term buyer might.
She's looking for 500.
Wow, I love it.
I wouldn't rule it out. Yeah, just it really depends.
One thing out of the earnings is they increased their credit facility to $3 billion from $1 billion. That's kind of a
big
increase.
What does that mean?
Right. And so once upon a time, that was part of the Netflix bear case, right? They're spending money, they're levered up, et cetera. They got a lot of debt. I don't know if that enters the picture at all right now, or if now is the time to spend money now that they are in the pole position in the streaming wars. Now is the time to sort of push them out even more in front of the rest.
I wouldn't take that approach. If you're already winning, you don't have to exacerbate it by spending more money, giving less metrics. I think that's not a winning scenario to up your spending and give less data. I don't think it's a recipe for success.
Yeah, I mean, that balance sheet is pristine, and you make the great point. We were really worried about how much they were spending on all that content, whether they were going to be able to monetize it, and how long they were going to have those cash flow losses, right? Like, it was a big suck, and I remember every quarter.
A big what?
Remember they would guide to.
What does that stand for?
It's not like peg or
ARPU. What's that?
Suck.
I was talking about Met.
I mean on the sentiment of the story.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
And sucking enthusiasm out of it or whatever. Now, if you look at this thing, it's got a $260 billion, and it's going down, you know, right now, and they have, you know, $7.5 billion in cash. They generate a lot of cash. They have $14 billion in debt. And look at Disney's balance sheet. I mean, like, it's a disaster. Yeah. Like there's a $200 billion equity. You know, they have some cash, but they have $47 billion in debt. We know that where that comes from. So, like, when you think about how they might be limited in content going forward, I mean, Netflix seems like a good spot.
I don't think they would be opening. It's hard to know whether a credit facility could be inferred to have some greater kind of strategic thought around it. And we've asked often, when is Netflix possibly going to do something more aggressive in gaming or in other parts of the sports world? I don't think they're probably we've talked about how they're not locking into a traditional, a professional sports league and signing on for the long haul there. But it's interesting, you know, why they're adding to a credit facility at a time when they are generating more free cash flow. I think the gaming world is still wide open for Netflix. And with the engagement they have and the subs they have and the global reach they have, I think that moves the needle.
We will get more on Netflix's conference call with Rich Greenfield of Lightshed Partners a little bit later on in the show. But meantime, the Dow eking out a gain today, while the S&P and Nasdaq both extended their losing streaks to 5 days. It is the longest stretch of down days for the S&P since October. And the chip stocks continue to get checked, with Taiwan Semi and Micron leading the group's losses today. The SMH ETF has now underperformed the broader market by 8% since hitting a record in early March. So where are stocks going from here? Of course, we'll turn to Katie for that. What do you see?
Well, you know, the semis tend to exhibit upside leadership during strong tapes and downside leadership during weaker tapes, right? So the downside leadership from SMH and the likes, and Micron included, is somewhat concerning from, I'd say, more of a short to intermediate term perspective. We have seen a very good run from the major indices, from the semiconductor benchmarks and stocks. So I think to see some kind of retracement is very healthy. And I do think this is the beginning of something a bit more significant. That said, with this 5 day plus downdraft, we do have oversold readings in market breadth that we haven't seen in some time, actually since the October low, based on something called the McClellan oscillator. It's a little bit maybe obscure to some folks, but it's derived from advancers and decliners and up and down volume. And it tells us that what we've seen is getting a little overdone, right? So we should have some kind of relief rally, and that might be something that people will sell into and then becomes our corrective phase. And think about our seasonal timing right now. We're coming into
May.
Sell in May, yeah. Period. And if you look at things like the VIX and other metrics that measure market sentiment, the VIX has kind of turned the corner. It's coming off of its lows. It's been in this low volatility cycle for some time. So we feel that the sentiment has shifted meaningfully. There's another index called the Fear and Greed Index that had been at these extremely greedy levels, which is a contrarian reading for the market. So that's what we think needs to be alleviated. And the only way usually to do that is either through sideways prolonged action or a proper corrective phase. So to get to that oversold sentiment data, we need a little bit more from the market.
So in terms of the oversold condition, according to the McClellan Oscillator, is that for the, that's for the broader indices. Does it also apply to SMH and to some of the individual components like an NVIDIA? I mean, SMH and NVIDIA are in corrective phases right now.
That's right. So we would expect tech and the mega caps, including NVIDIA, to do best in the very near term during an oversold bounce. But it's super top down when this happens. When the market gets more fearful, they sort of throw all the stocks in together and they treat them all as a group or as an asset class. So it makes more sense when you're thinking about getting hedged, your exposure, or reducing exposure. You may want to reduce more on the opportunistic higher beta names, but to just get hedged from a top-down perspective, maybe using inverse S&P 500 ETFs or something of that nature, usually it's the best way to navigate it as opposed to going to the individual positions and scrutinizing them.
And when you look at CTA accounts, we all file that on this desk, I would assume. They've exhausted, too, to the downside, so that you would think there's going to be a bounce. The only thing I'm bearish about is that we usually don't test the 50 and not test the 100 or the 200. Now, the 200 is at 4670-ish or thereabouts. I'm looking for a test of the 200-day, so that bounce could be faded. Mm-hmm. And then we wind up there anyway.
Yeah, and there's a breakout point of roughly 4810, right? That was where the S&P 500 reached a new all-time high above that level. Former resistance often becomes support going forward. It also happens to be very close to a Fibonacci retracement level on the chart. So that 4810 to about 4820 is a significant level. It'd be great to see the market hold up there. It's not very far from current levels, but if we do see a good bounce, which we're looking for, then maybe we're talking 8 to 10% even.
How do these technicals line up with what we are hearing from the Fed? And the Fed more recently. Kashkari today was saying the Fed may not cut rates until next year. And Williams just today said, you know, it's not his base case scenario that there will be a rate hike, but if the data warrants it, that's what we'll do. So, well, that's on the table now.
It's a great point because the fundamentals are driving some of the technicals, although the technicals folks, I mean, I'm not sure. Do you refer to this as funny mentals as well as Carter does?
No.
But I think that's a great point. I think you have a case where higher rates have certainly injected more volatility into the markets. But some of these levels we're talking about in terms of the peak of the semiconductors and whatnot were also inspired by, you know, those NVIDIA 4Q numbers, I think, were released February 6th or 7th or 8th, and the market basically gapped up to that. Semis have come all the way down to the top of that gap. So they've given a lot back. If you look at the NASDAQ, so if you're following triple Qs, they're on a relative basis to the S&P, they're flat from October 16th, which was that big market pivot day. So the leadership that you want to see from the market, we haven't really had it. I think it also comes, there's a lot of different things. Steve talks about CTAs, and maybe that helps you on some level if you think about where things might be a little bit oversold. But if you look at hedge fund gross exposure, and that's basically adding up their shorts and their longs, but They're at 90th percentile. I know this sounds weird. The bottom line is, I think people are still very complacent on where risk could be.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, Katie, you mentioned the 4,800 level. That was the prior high. 4,600 was that July 2023 high that we sold off 11% from. I think we get back to probably in that 4,600 range. It's probably a bit oversold there. That would be a 12% peak to trough decline. Last year, we had 11%. Mm-hmm. Every year, we pretty much have a 10%. So I think that's coming to a theory.
And here, I think we're better served focusing on the indicators during a corrective phase as opposed to levels. You can use levels as a gauge of risk, but it's when we do see that oversold indication and then we see stabilization, we call it support discovery, that's enough to lead to upturns in those indicators. That's where we feel that we have opportunity. to Melissa's question on yields, really, you know, we do actually have a short-term breakout in yields, but at the same time, we have a sign of upside exhaustion from the DeMarc indicators. So we're looking for a two-week pullback in yields, and that would sort of align with an oversold bounce perhaps in equities, but then for it to roll over again in equities, and then maybe one more push higher, maybe not all the way to 5% resistance, but somewhere closer to it.
Coming up, TikTok nearing midnight as lawmakers speed up the clock on divest or ban bill, the risks facing closed-end funds, and some fast movers catching our traders' attention. We'll lay out how to play the moves higher. But first, Tesla's stall continues as more analysts unplug from the EV maker, where Wall Street sees risk and where the stock might be able to find some support next. Don't go anywhere. Fast Money's back in two.
This is Fast Money with Melissa Lee. Right here on CNBC.
Hello, I'm Laura Castleton, U.S. Head of Portfolio Construction and Strategy at Janus Henderson Investors. Is a brighter future possible? At Janus Henderson, we think it is. For 90 years, we've worked to help clients achieve superior financial outcomes and fulfill our purpose of investing in a brighter future together. We know that this means our thinking and our investments are helping to shape millions of brighter futures for the next 90 years and beyond. To learn more, go to janushenderson.com.
The spirit of performance defines Acura, and now it's electric. Introducing the all-electric ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura has been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
Welcome back. Tesla hitting a new 52-week low today, closing just below $150 a share. The move coming after a long-time bull, downgrading the stock to a hold and slashing its price target to $123 from $189. That is 18% lower from today's close. Deutsche Bank's Emmanuel Rosner had a buy rating on Tesla since 2021, but after the EV maker canceled plans for the cheaper Model 2 earlier this month, he sees more pressure on volume and pricing, lower earnings for years to come. He also makes the point that if the company is going to shift to robotaxi, that's a much sort of a longer term payoff. And who's going to own the stock in the meantime? Will there be a transition of ownership to investors who have a longer term time horizon, maybe value investors at this point? And that transition will be a painful one.
Well, there's no question. It does seem to be now consensus, not only that folks should be downgrading their price targets, but that there's no real catalyst for Tesla in the next 18 months, and that you're looking to maybe end at 25 before you start to see some reacceleration and some other dynamics. Has the company, have they refuted, has anybody confirmed whether the Model 2?
I was going to say, it looks like they are going to cancel. But Elon Musk called the Reuters report, which initially had that out there, as a lie.
You know, or so, some other definitely.
And any other company CEO that says a report is a lie, we would say, okay, that report's not true. But for some reason with Elon Musk,
right,
there is still a doubt and a belief that the Model 2 will be canceled.
Well, if the Model 2 is being canceled, again, the inference was that it's because there's a competitive landscape, especially in China, that it just doesn't make any sense right now. And if that's the case, well, first of all, we can already connect those dots. We kind of know what's going on with China demand and the competitive landscape there. So I don't think it's cheap enough yet for value.
I think you've had incredible demand destruction. So picking up on that Model 2, if he commits to a Model 2, the analyst community has seen that only as robotaxi. So if he commits to a low-priced Model 2, then he gives some sort of a margin guidance on it, pricing guidance on it. But this is definitely 30% Elon Musk, the board, and 70% demand destruction at this point. So you've got to figure out what happens with full self-drive. Is he going to be there? Is he going to develop with Tesla or not? But remember, the last time we flirted with 100, the stock shot up to 300, too.
If he doesn't get this, $60 billion or something like that? Just to be clear, that would be a percentage of the current market cap.
If he doesn't get $60 billion from what?
The pay package, okay. So, like, think about that. That's like 15% of the market cap right now. Why would he deserve that? Like, think about this. We have been in a runaway bull market for basically 3.5 years, and this company has gone sideways to down, you know what I mean? And really off a lot of decisions that he has made himself. So, you know, it used to be that there's this big premium in the stock because of his presence. You could say, well, why would this guy who's a CEO of five different companies, why would he deserve that when they basically made
if he stepped away, would the stock go down?
It would get crushed immediately, but then ultimately, if they put a real operator in there, you know what I mean? Like Tim Cook or something like that. I'm just not Tim Cook, but a guy like Tim
right,
Cook.
Right, somebody who focuses on operations.
Then
he's got his own failure going on right now.
Just quickly, Katie, what's the next thought for Tesla?
You know, it is long-term oversold, but the last time that happened, it took several months for it to come out of it. And what we want to see here, too, is some support discovery. There's some minor support around 148. Below that, we're talking about 102. So let's make sure we have that support discovery and we see not just the oversold, but the reaction to it.
Coming up, we're keeping an eye on Netflix. That stock at after-hours session lows. The conference call is about to wrap up. Top media analyst Rich Greenfield of Lightshed Partners joins us to lay out the headlines from the call. But first, time flies when you're facing a ban. A lawmaker's fast-tracking a bill that could determine TikTok's fate. What it means for the app and how Chinese owner ByteDance will respond. That's next. You're watching Fast Money live from the Nasdaq market site in Times Square. Back right after this.
For more than a decade, Comcast has been committed to bridging the digital divide and connecting millions to affordable, high-speed internet. But the barriers to get connected go well beyond affordability. Through Project Up, Comcast is committing $1 billion to reach millions with digital skills training, resources, and opportunities needed to succeed in a digital world. Project Up, building a future of unlimited possibilities. Learn more at comcast.com/projectup.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Stocks losing steam late in the day. The Dow managing a small gain while the S&P and Nasdaq both fell into the red, both with five-day losing streaks. Shares of Las Vegas Sands sinking nearly 9% after yesterday's earnings report. The company posting a top and bottom line beat, but numbers out of Macau missed analyst expectations. United Airlines up another 6% today, nearly 24% since earnings just on Tuesday. The airline delivering a strong forecast despite ongoing issues with Boeing deliveries. And an e-commerce call out of Morgan Stanley, analysts there laying out a pairs trade, double upgrading eBay while downgrading competitor Etsy. eBay up nearly 15% this year, while Etsy is down 17%. And shares of Apple supplier Jabil down slightly after hours. The company saying the CEO was placed on leave pending an investigation related to corporate policies. That stock is down 2%. Meantime, Congress potentially fast-tracking a bill that would crack down on TikTok. The legislation requiring TikTok owner ByteDance to sell the app or face a ban in the U.S. could be attached to an aid package for Ukraine and Israel. For more on what this means to ByteDance and the bill's chances in the House, let's get to CNBC's Emily Wilkins. Emily, what's the latest on this?
Hey, Melissa. Well, yeah, the legislation that could lead to a TikTok ban in the U.S. now has a new path to potential passage via the $95 billion foreign aid package the House is currently working on. The House lawmakers, they're debating this foreign aid package for Ukraine, Israel, the Indo-Pacific, but that funding could also be accompanied by a number of other measures aimed at national security, and that includes that measure that would require TikTok to fully divest from parent company ByteDance. Now, attaching the TikTok bill to this larger funding package does make it more likely to pass the Senate. This bill would also lengthen the amount of time that TikTok has to find a buyer to 9 months. That's up from 6 months in the initial bill. And it could be as much as a year if the president decides to grant some additional time. And that was one of the big concerns that's been pushed for by Senator Maria Cantwell. She's a senator who was working to update the House passed bill in the Senate. And in a statement, she said she was pleased with House leadership had incorporated her suggested changes and is, quote, extending the divestment period sees that as necessary to ensure there's enough time for a new buyer to get a deal done. She says she supports the updated legislation. Meanwhile, TikTok is upping its lobbying efforts. CNBC confirmed that they are doubling their ad buys to 4.5 million. But of course, for TikTok to have a shot, the House actually needs to move that foreign aid funding package, something Speaker Mike Johnson is really struggling to do here. A small group of hardliner Republicans is not only working to block the aid package, but but have threatened to oust Johnson unless he adds border security provisions. So, Melissa, a lot of factors here going back and forth on Capitol Hill. But, of course, we're keeping a very close eye on that package and on TikTok.
On the TikTok piece of it, Emily, it seems like analysts or Washington analysts believe that there's a pretty decent chance, more than 50%, that it will pass. What are Washington observers saying about that?
I mean, Speaker Mike Johnson has made it very clear that he wants to get this package of Ukraine aid done. And look, there are the votes to do it. It's just a question of how Johnson makes that work with the very, very narrow majority that he's got. And that's where you're seeing some headway when it comes to exactly getting this bill to the floor, potentially having the votes. They're doing a lot of really wonky procedural stuff here trying to make that work. But I think the fact that Cantwell has signed off of it, I mean, she was a senator right now who is kind of holding up a bit of the process on TikTok. So the fact that she's come out with a green light means that as long as the House is able to get this done, the Senate will likely take it up and be able to move that through with TikTok.
All right, Emily, thank you. Emily Wilkins. We've seen 2 days of reaction from Snap. We saw Meta with a pretty decent day, considering the tape here. What do we think? Is there the impact?
Pretty savvy move for a guy who's this Johnson. You know what I mean?
So because cramming in the
Listen, this thing has had so many different iterations, right? Yeah. The people within his own party, the way the Dems kind of turned on the TikTok thing. The Republicans don't want the Ukraine aid. In the House, they're okay with some stuff, and the Senate, they're not. So maybe we get all of it at once. And people don't seem too bothered by TikTok. I don't know. But a bunch of senators who don't even use it seem more bothered by it, I guess.
I think the big issue is one we talk about all the time is just related to the fact that this is the Chinese embassy has approached the Hill and basically indicated this is a Chinese company and you wouldn't be doing this to a company in any other with national origin someplace else in the world. And so it is becoming political. It does seem almost that the diplomatic channels are trying what they can do. By the way, at first the Chinese embassy approached the Hill in a way that they weren't talking about TikTok, and then they're referring to, a Chinese-owned company. And so I feel like this is just going through a process where at some point, you get the outcome that we talk about in terms of the impact on American companies in China.
Coming up, all the headlines out of Netflix's conference call. Rich Greenfield of Lightshed Partners brings us the latest from that call and where he sees that stock heading next. Plus, destined for danger, be careful. We will lay out the potential risks on closed-end funds like the Destiny Tech 100, how the once soaring name has fallen back down to earth. Fast Money's back in two. Welcome back to Fast Money. Another check on Netflix after earnings. Shares are now down more than 4%, just about 4%. The call just wrapping up. Let's get some details from that call from Lightshed Partners, Rich Greenfield. Rich, why is the stock lower, you think?
You have a bunch of investors who are essentially panicking, worrying that no longer disclosing subscriber numbers is it basically speaks to the fact that subscriber growth is over. This company has blown away expectations for subscriber growth over the last couple of quarters. I mean, two of their biggest quarters ever, excluding the pandemic. And I think people are just looking at next year saying, oh, they're not going to disclose subscriber numbers. That must signal a problem. It actually reminds me, Melissa, a few years ago when they stopped disclosing subscriber guidance and only basically guided to revenues, people worried that that was a sign of problems to come. I think it's just investors digesting how this company positions itself financially, and people like to worry. And look, this has been an incredible stock performance-wise year to date. And I think this is just people being worried that this is a negative data point. I don't think it actually will be, but I think that's the near-term knee-jerk reaction.
What do you make, or what's your take about the credit facility being increased to $3 billion from $1 billion? What do you think they do with that, if anything?
Look, I think Netflix is in an incredibly strong financial position. I mean, you look at, think about Paramount Plus, which has lost, $5, $6 billion. Peacock, which has probably lost $7 billion. Disney, which has lost $8, $9 billion. Like, the losses have piled up everywhere. Netflix is going to generate $6 billion of positive free cash flow. So for all the non-believers or the haters that this was never going to turn into a real business, this business is gushing cash. And while everyone else in the industry is pulling back, spending less, cutting their marketing spend, cutting their programming budget, I mean, you can't even name a recent show on a Paramount Plus.
So why do they
need
it?
There's just nothing.
If they're spitting out cash, why do they need that?
Just flexibility. I wouldn't read too much into it. I mean, look,
not like a big acquisition or anything like that?
Netflix making acquisitions for a long time. Did you lose me? I'm sorry.
Froze for a moment.
Sorry about that.
Go ahead.
Sorry, traveling. Look, there's no need for an acquisition. I really don't think that there's an acquisition coming. That has never been the Netflix playbook. They have built this from scratch. Could there be some small interactive entertainment video game acquisitions of small studios? Always possible. I mean, they've bought small IP, Ronald Dahl. I mean, they have bought IP, small things. I'd be very surprised if there was a major acquisition for Netflix anytime over the course of the next several years.
Rich, when we talk about the password sharing, what inning do you think we're in that? And is the next leg now the ad base, which clears the deck for them to raise prices?
Look, the advertising business is still very early stage. They've been pretty blunt, and I think Greg actually answered my question on the call today, that they're still seeing overall advertising supply outstripping demand. You know, they're growing so fast. They probably have 13 million ad-supported subscribers, probably 10 million in the U.S. You know, a very healthy percentage of the U.S. business is now ad-supported. They're actually growing that the amount of available slots faster than they're actually growing the ad business. It's going to take time. It's actually a great problem to have. It's just basically bringing on more advertisers, getting people comfortable with what they're doing. That's where you're actually going to see ARPU really start to accelerate. And basically what they've told you is as advertising ARPU accelerates, it gives them more capacity to actually raise the price of the non-advertising. The ad-free product will go up in price. And so I think all of this is leading to having more pricing power over the course of the next few years. It takes time, but I think the ad product, you know, look at what's happening to linear TV. Mm-hmm. Less and less viewership, more and more cord cutting. All of this is showing the need to be on Netflix, Prime Video, all of these streaming platforms. Advertisers are dying to be there. Mm-hmm. That's a big opportunity. And I think part of removing the subscriber guidance is really a shift. The growth is going to start to come from the revenue side. That's where they want to focus people.
Just to be clear, though, Rich, you mentioned accelerating ARPU, but we're not going to get that number anymore, right?
Well, they're going to give you subscribers on a infrequent basis. I don't know if that's every 50 million. Like, I don't know what the metric's going to be. But clearly, the revenue growth, you know, we're still going to do the math, roughly estimating what subscribers are and what ARPU is. Sure, absolutely.
Yeah.
You just won't have all the pieces every quarter.
Right. Rich, thanks. Good to see you. Rich Greenfield, LightShed Partners. So as Steve pointed out before, we won't actually have to explain ARPU anymore because we're not really going to talk about it too much.
Tim, it's been nice knowing you on the show. You had a good run.
Nothing left for me. Nothing left for me. What's interesting about the comparison of Netflix that I'm going to make to Meta is that when Meta started growing and moving, you know, in all the generations that we thought they should not and basically needed to pull back and become the year of efficiency, the stock started rallying. And obviously there's an AA component to this. But again, the metaverse was a big spend and something that bothered people. Netflix generating free cash flow and giving some back to investors and showing that that's all they want to do, I think can take the stock higher.
Coming up, close-end caution, the potential risks of investing in close-end funds. We'll take a look at what you can learn from the massive reversal in the Destiny Tech 100. That is next. And some key stocks catching our traders' eyes, how they are handling D.R. Horton, Wells Fargo. Straight ahead, Fast Money's back in two. Welcome back to Fast Money. Destiny Tech 100, a close-end fund allowing retail investors to put money into private companies, came out of the gate soaring, hitting a high of $105 just days after its March 26 debut. That was a gain of about 1,200%, but it has fallen 70% from those highs. Last week, Destiny's CEO Sohail Prasad joined us here on the desk, touting the product as a liquid and transparent way for individual investors to get in early on private tech, like OpenAI and SpaceX. But that enthusiasm left us with more questions than answers. With the fund still in its early innings and shares trading at a steep premium to net asset value, let's try to get some answers now with Bob Pisani, who's been covering the world of funds for years here at CNBC. You've been digging in, Bob. What'd you find?
Well, you know, Destiny Tech 100 is a very good example of what happens when high demand meets very limited availability. So, as you mentioned, this is a closed-end fund. And like all closed-end funds, it consists essentially of a box that holds assets. In this case, it's shares of private tech companies like SpaceX or Epic Games or Discord and Stripe. Like all closed-end funds, the fund has issued a limited number of shares that trade on the New York Stock Exchange. There's big retail interest in accessing shares of private companies like SpaceX, but because those shares are not publicly available, investors have bid up the price of the fund far beyond the total value of the fund's asset, as you mentioned, the net asset value, or NAV. Now, since it began trading on March 26th, the fund's gone from a low of $8.25 right on the first day to, as you mentioned, Melissa, $105. It's now $31 and change. However, as of December 31st, the net asset value of the securities was, you listening to this, $4.84 a share. With 10.8 million shares issued, the net assets of the firm is $52.6 million. But it's currently trading with a market capitalization of $342 million. This fund is trading at a crazy high multiple, a premium to the value of the underlying shares. Its current price assumes essentially that the value of all the underlying shares, once they go public or are acquired, is more than six times their last valuation. Now, why would investors do this? Obviously, investor desire to get into the hot private market for tech companies, even at a very high cost, is the big motivator here. The fact, though, that there is a very limited supply of shares is also really the critical factor here. So given the limited supply and the intense investor demand, a company might rationally make a decision to float a lot more shares. Guess what? That's exactly what they're doing. The company filed a $1 billion stock offering this Tuesday. That's not a typo, $1 billion. And Melissa, what's going on here is, of course, the imperfect structure of the closed-end fund with the premium and discount. If you really want to solve the problem, it would be great to have an exchange-traded fund that held the underlying shares, and you could trade it at the net asset value during the day. The problem is you can't do that because the underlying shares of these private companies are not liquid enough to enable an exchange-traded fund to function. And so you have these imperfect vehicles like closed-end funds. Kathy Woods has an ARK interval fund that trade. It's just not a great way to deal with hot demand for these kinds of things. Let's get them to go public. How about that idea? Wouldn't that be nice?
the person who's putting money into this, though, Bob, they're also paying a lot. I mean, it's a 2.5% fee. But if you're paying a 2.5% fee on something that trades at such a premium to net asset value, it seems like you're really getting, I don't want to use the word fleeced, but you're paying a lot to be in this for a net asset value of $52 million.
Right. Remember, this happened with the Bitcoin fund a while ago, too. Essentially, you have a box that holds Bitcoin and charging 1.5% on top of that. And it traded, of course, sometimes at premiums and sometimes at tremendous discounts. This is just very difficult. What happens when you've got a company like SpaceX that sits out there and everybody wants to access it and they can't at the same time? This is the kind of thing that you get and the imperfect system that we have. I wish there was a better way to do it. I just want companies to stop sitting there for years and years in the private market, not going public. And we need to have more incentives for them to go public, frankly.
Bob, thank you.
Okay.
Bob Pisani at the New York Stock Exchange with this one. By the way, the CEO, just 2 days after appearing on Fast Money, sold shares, 200,000 shares for about $5 million. So he's been selling.
Yeah, that bothers me. The promotional nature of the marketing of this fund bothers me, and the return profile of what you could get. What bothers me is also that the stakes of the underlying companies are something you have to be very careful of. I mean, that an SPV might own a piece of one of these private companies. And again, are there fees in that? And what's the real ownership of the SPV? So I just, you know, one of the things I brought up that night, I think, and it's what Bob was saying, I mean, structurally, this just doesn't make sense, right? There's no way you can have a match of liquidity in a private in private companies like this in a public vehicle. And it leaves you a closed end fund. I mean, there's an expression on Wall Street. I mean, closed-end funds sometimes are roach motels. You could check in, but, you know, we know what the answer is on that.
Yeah, so I think people have to understand that a closed-end fund is not a liquid instrument. I think it's more lack of understanding what this is. And if he sold stock, it's a bad luck. If he's promotional and then he sells stock, it's a bad luck. the SEC will decide if he broke any laws, but I don't think he broke any laws, right? It's just a bad look.
We're not saying that he's broken
any I just want to make sure that we say he didn't break any laws. We're not saying he broke any laws.
No.
It's a bad look, though, to be promotional and then sell into it.
Right.
But there's plenty of IPOs that fail. You always have an instrument where you can always poke holes in the end. People have to know what they're buying.
Yeah. Don't go anywhere. More Fast Money in two. Welcome back to Fast Money. D.R. Horton rising nearly 6% at its highs of the day after posting an earnings beat. The company also hiking its full-year revenue forecast, saying the shortage of existing homes is bullish for new construction demand. Shares gave back most of the gains, closing near the flat line. How does this look, Katie?
You know, all of the home builders working together have lost upside momentum, and we have negative divergences. So to me, it's not terribly surprising that we saw DHI sold into that rally. And I would look for selling opportunities for now, at least, and look for a better buying opportunity once they're more oversold from an intermediate term perspective. They've had such a good run. They've had very good relative performance. So I think this is a healthy corrective phase.
Mortgage rates over 7% for the first time this year.
Yeah, I mean, that and if those are the same headlines that had the home builders, you know, 50% ago. So I just think the demand story, the fundamental story, why there's housing demand in this country and it won't change. It's probably getting worse. I get that. But the interest rate sensitivity here for these things that are near all time highs, I'd be fading.
Yeah, you need to see the horizon where they're actually lowering rates. You will take a stance. You'll lift the leg on buying something. I know you don't know what that means.
Whoa.
So it's when you do a two-part trade, right? You'll lift a leg if you see
a leg of a trade.
Oh. Exactly.
A leg of a trade. Yes. Okay. All right. Let's clarify.
I got a tough visual on that.
So if you see rates coming down, you'll do something where you say, "All right, I'll take a short-term mortgage for a longer-term profit."
All right.
Glad we got to the bottom of that.
You know, up next, final trades. Final trade time, Tim.
Energy transfer partners think MLPs are going higher.
Katie Stockton.
I'll go with NVIDIA bouncing off of its 50-day moving average.
Dan.
Yeah, I think IGB is following semis, probably risk to 75.
Steve Presso.
The halving is upon us. IBIT, iShares Bitcoin Trust.
Katie, thank you so much for being with us.
Of course.
Katie Stockton, the fair lead. Thank you for watching Fast Money. Mad Money with Jim Cramer starts right now.
All opinions expressed by the Fast Money participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information the Fast Money participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Fast Money disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/fastmoneydisclaimer.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.